Welcome to the Wildcard Hour on KVNF, where we bring you the best of radio documentaries and talk shows. I'm Jody Peterson, and tonight we have a special treat, Act Two of Uranium, the Musical. This radio drama was written and produced by Marty Derlin. Act One aired last Friday, May 17th, and if you missed it, you can find it on our website, kvnf.org. Next up, we have a brief interview with Marty, the playwright, describing her work, followed by Act Two of Uranium. We are speaking with Marty Derlin, the former general manager of KZMU in Moab, and now she's the director, writer, and producer of an original drama. The play is set in 1956 as a uranium boom is sweeping through Moab, Grand Junction, Uravan, and other Western Slope towns. Marty, can you tell us in a little more detail what your play is about?
As you say, it's set in 1956. That was kind of the peak maybe of the uranium boom in Moab. It seemed like a really fascinating time. And I remember going to Grand Junction and seeing a film about uranium and going to Moab and thinking, what a dull town. All over the Colorado Plateau, there was a lot of prospecting for uranium and quite a bit of uranium mining. I chose that time really because of the people who were alive during that moment and in Moab. Charlie Steen, known as the Uranium King, was a young geologist from Texas, and he hit a huge vein of uranium in 1952 when he was only 33 and just became fantastically wealthy. Edward Abbey was out at Arches for his first season, writing the stuff that would eventually become Desert Solitaire. The play became really a comedy rather than the historical drama that it might have been. And I mixed fictional characters in there to make it lively. There was a real frenzy. You know, once Charlie Steen hit it big with multi-million-dollar find, that everyone thought it was a possibility. So it really, you know, that kind of boomtown mentality when everybody's a little crazy and kind of desperate. That was going on all over the Colorado Plateau. And we do touch on the effects of radiation and uranium as a hazardous material and all of that.
And that was Marty Derlin, writer and producer of Uranium the Musical. Next up, we have Act Two. If you missed Act One, which aired last week, you can find it at kvnf.org.
The next day, I drove the long dirt road to see Ranger Ed. I found him exchanging views with a gaggle of tourists.
Say, Ranger, how the hell did we get out of here?
You just got here, ma'am.
I know, but how the hell did we get out?
Same way you came in. It's a dead-end road.
So we see the same scenery twice?
It looks better going out.
Ranger, do you live in that little house trailer down there?
Yes, ma'am. Part of the time. Mostly, I live out of it.
Say, are you married?
Not seriously.
Well, you must get awfully lonesome way out here.
No, I have good company.
Oh, your wife?
No, myself.
Well, what do you do for amusement?
Talk to the tourists.
Any dangerous animals out here, Ranger?
Just the tourists.
Does it ever rain in this country, Ranger?
I don't know, ma'am. I've only been here 11 years. That concludes the session for today, folks. So if you just step this way to the campgrounds and picnic tables, be sure to let me know if you get lost. It's a great country, Decatur. You can say whatever you want so long as it's strictly true, and nobody will ever take you seriously.
Oh, yeah, lots of laughs.
So here's the first question. Why should we help Charlie Steen?
Well, there's the $500 per day for me, of course.
So there's that, and we could draw out the case to the end of the week. And perhaps $1,000 a day is more like it, considering the caper Steen has in mind.
I like how you're thinking, Ed.
Second question. How much danger does it pose for you?
On a scale of 1 to 10? 10.
Question number 3. What is the worst case scenario?
The Russians get the uranium and... Wait, no. The worst is they kill me and get the uranium.
So we've established that the stakes are high.
A 10, but... I like to live on the edge, farther from the ground, nearer to the sky.
So do I.
I like to soar through the air. I will take a dare, even though I'm scared.
I will not beware, even though I might be impaired.
What's the point in life unless you go all the way? Every minute of the day, come what may. What's the point in life if you don't have ambitions that come to fruition and provoke all the folks? I like to soar through the air, walk the edge, take a chance, dance the dance of my lifetime.
Nearer to the sky, till the day I die.
But your idea... How to handle this thing?
Well, here's what I'm thinking. We need something yellow.
After my meeting with Ranger Ed, I drove the long road to Moab once again. I was pretty hungry, so I stopped by Milt's for some sustenance.
Well, if it isn't that detective girl. Hi. See there, Bob?
Howdy. How do you do?
Well, howdy. How's the prospecting?
Well, I'm beginning to think Charlie Steen's got everything already. Only time my Geiger counter goes off and is in here at Milt's. Here, I'll show you.
Shut that thing off, Bob.
Well, I can't figure out why it only works here at Milt's, unless it really is his meat.
What'll it be, Decatur?
Wait a minute, Milt. Where'd you get that watch?
Why, it came from my Uncle Pete. Milt always admired it, so Pete gave it to him for his last birthday. He said it was old, from about 40 years ago or so.
I see it's luminescent. Looks a little greenish, too. Could it possibly be a radium dial?
Oh, well,
they made a lot of them back then.
Oh, excuse me, I bet you're right about that.
No wonder my machine keeps going off.
Why don't you just buy it off Milt, Bob? That way you could always pretend you're discovering something.
Well, I don't know. I mean, Audrey's uncle did give it to me.
You did always admire it.
Would you take $10 for it, Milt?
You want to be careful that it doesn't have a crack in it, Milt. Even very old radium remains radioactive. And, of course, radium paint can be ingested just by inhaling flaking paint particles. The alpha particles emitted by the radium will kill off surrounding bone tissue, creating tumors. Inhaled or ingested particles may deposit a high local dose with a risk of lung or gastrointestinal cancer. Oh, and I'll have a cheeseburger, some fries, and a small vanilla malt, Milt.
Coming right up.
Howdy.
Hi, Jack Holly, is it? The man they call the Goat Man? Welcome. I don't think you've ever been here.
Nope. Sure have heard about it, though, over... past 2 years.
Good Lord, that man has never taken a bath in his life. He's reeking.
He's stinking the whole place up. Hey, we're going to be outside today, Milt.
All right. I'm
see you
outside.
Later.
Oh, fine. Bye.
All right.
Hope I didn't offend anyone.
Oh, no. Well, what would you like?
Heard you have a good burger.
That's right.
That's what I'll have.
Nice to see you, Jack. What brings you here?
Just hungry. Say, you know we were speaking of uranium the other day?
Yes.
Funny thing, just after you left, some Russian folks showed up.
How did you know they were Russians?
Well, they said they were from Norway, but I heard all kinds of languages in my travels when I was over there in Europe. These folks spoke Russian in between asking me about Charlie Steen.
What did they want to know?
Was he a man of his word? Well, I said yes.
You know Steen?
That's right. Invited me to his big party this year, coming right up. Asked me to take a bath first, though.
That's a good idea, Jack.
Now, as a rule, I take a bath only on Christmas Day. Mrs. Anderson invites me to bathe in her clawfoot tub, and then I sit in the parlor and have a home-cooked meal with the family.
That's nice, but back to the Russians. Was there anything else? There were two of them, you say?
One man, one woman. They were curious about the goats.
Oh?
Asked about the milk, so I gave them a taste. Short one said it would be good milk for schnitzel. Now, that's some drink the Russians make with goat milk, berries, and syrup. In Norway, their goat milk specialty is a sort of brown cheese that has kind of caramel taste. Brunost, they call it.
You really are a walking encyclopedia, Jack.
I've spent my entire life acquiring knowledge. Used to be from books and travel and being in the wars. Now all I do is read the newspapers. Also just look at the rocks, the river, the goats, the dogs, the sky, people driving by.
There you go, Jack. And coffee? You want some coffee?
Oh, sure do, Milt. Thank you.
One man and one woman, you say, Jack. Did you get their names?
One is Anastasia, like the princess. That's the woman. And the man is Nikita, like cruise chef.
Thanks, Jack. Let me buy you lunch. Milt, keep the change. I've got to go.
Yeah, you know, I think I'll step outside for a moment, too. Will you excuse me, Jack? Need a breath of fresh air. You coming, Audrey?
You bet I am, Milt. I am right behind you.
Oh, food sure is good. Surprised there aren't more people in here. Yeah, it's odd.
Oh, well, if it isn't the goat man! Goat man! Goat man! Oh.
How you doing, Mary?
I didn't need a little money, goat man. I need a little job. Hey, you got any jobs? You got any money?
I got enough to buy you lunch.
Well, that'd be awful nice, but I need some real money. I need it. How about uranium? You got any uranium?
Yeah, a few rocks left over from my prospecting days. Got a little carnotite.
Ooh, don't suppose you'd give me any of that, would ya? Would ya?
Maybe. What do you want it for?
Well, a couple from Denmark? Or was it Norway? I don't. They're looking for some uranium to make clocks with. Said they'd pay real good.
Clocks, you say?
Tick-a-tick, talkity-tick-tock! Hey, you gonna eat that last French fry?
It was pretty obvious that the couple claimed to be from Scandinavia wasn't from around these parts. If Jack was correct, they were actually from Russia. And they must be the Russian spies Charlie was talking about.
We are strangers in a very strange land.
People always stare at us as our hero to obtain uranium.
The United States President Eisenhower is just giving it away. 44,000 pounds of it.
As your president, I say it is not enough to take this weapon from the hands of the soldiers. It must be put into the hands of those who will know how to strip its military casing and adapt it to the arts of peace. Yes, atoms for peace.
The American president is giving all aid to countries which are deemed friendly to the United States of America, such as Syria, Pakistan, Turkey, Bangladesh, Algeria, Colombia, Jamaica, Ghana, Peru, and the Belgian Congo.
Of course, the American contractors will profit by building the nuclear facilities. That is the way of capitalism, which exploits the American worker and continues the imperialism of the West around the world.
We, on the other hand, are most friendly comrades, extending friendly hands to citizens, offering to pay real dollars.
We are partaking in capitalism, but
we are protruding like
a sort of
here in Moab.
We are strangers
in a very strange land.
We try to be gregarious, but people always glare at us. We merely wish to be a pleasant face.
Lonely.
I am feeling so lonely.
I am missing my people.
I am missing my home.
Lonely.
How I long for my homeland.
How I long for my snares, hawk.
And my vodka and caviar. We wish to be ambassadors of goodwill to the American people.
We wish to obtain some of their high-grade uranium.
For peaceful purposes.
Should not be a problem.
We are going to a party here in Moab. We are not exactly invited.
But we have been told we will be welcome.
Everybody's welcome.
It is America.
We'll mingle and we're sure to fit right in.
We can be Swedish.
Yeah, or Norwegian.
We will fool the American uranium king.
And when it comes to the purchase, we will actually pay with phony currency that is worthless.
He will fall for it like a ton of building material.
Hilarious, but our situation is precarious. Russian spies about to make a deal for real, a capitalist deal, a steal for real.
Okay now, AML, let's rehearse. We've had enough lessons now to perform in public, don't you think?
Oh, I think so.
Never took me for a rumba dancer, did you?
I've taken you for many things, Charles, but never a rumba dancer, no.
All right now, well, I've surpassed all your wildest expectations.
Every last one.
Dance the rumba, it's like the samba, it's like the tango with a bit of cha-cha-cha. We dance the rumba,
it's like the mambo,
mambo, and the Spanish words go la 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 la. To get by.
Sure, it may be extravagant flying to Salt Lake City for rumba lessons, but we enjoy it, don't we, honey?
We sure do enjoy it.
And as the music plays and as your partner sways, you join the rumba craze and you will find the way to set your heart ablaze, to find the words to praise, to clear away the haze, to be amazed.
Together
as the time begins to fly, you step and stumble
and you get humble,
humble, and you need dancing lessons to get by.
Call me Charlie. This here's my wife, ML.
ML, Charlie, yes. Hello. How do you do? I'm Anna. This is Nikki. Thank you for inviting us to your very great party.
Well, we invited all of Moab, all of Grand County, and San Juan County. Half of Colorado. The food's coming from Texas. So why not a couple folks from,
Where are you from?
Norway.
Sweden.
Scandinavia. How nice.
Well, thanks for coming. Have yourselves a good time.
Nice to meet you.
We dance the rumba. It's like the samba. It's like a mambo with a big cha-cha-cha. Like the tango. It's like the salsa. And the Spanish words go la 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 la.
How you doing with the kids, Ma?
Oh, Charlie, the boys are completely wild. Don't you ever discipline them?
Not too much, do we, honey?
Not too much, no.
Certainly not when we're having a party.
Well, you do have other attributes, Charlie dear. When Charlie was a little boy, he loved to play with rocks. He built them into castles, and he hid them in his socks. Oh, I saw the blind ambition. I saw him fight through tears. I saw the boundless energy that helped him conquer fear. The way that Charlie gets through life is he perseveres. Pretty sure it's not his dad's side. So I must be a genius too. When Charlie grew into a man, he still played with rocks. People called him crazy, but he handled his hard knocks. Oh, I shared his get-rich vision. I financed his career, and when it seemed so hopeless, I tried to help and cheer, 'cause I know the way you get through life is you persevere. But it's better if
you are a genius. My boy's a genius.
Charlie's party with my entourage in tow and a plan I wasn't sure would succeed. The site was at the airport, south of town. There was a huge cargo plane by the big hangar. The smell of Texas barbecue was drifting through the air. An orchestra was playing. There were long tables set with dinnerware and other long tables being loaded with a cafeteria of food flown in from Dallas. Barbecued ribs and beef, piles of cornbread, slaw and potato salad, a variety of pies. There were bottles of booze, both covered in paper bags and right out in the open. It was the place to be, and everyone was there, even Crazy Mary.
Charlie Steen invited me special. He likes people who are characters. So does ML.
Ed was there, Ernie was there,
it was impossible to tell the invited guests from the party crashers, and it didn't seem to matter anyway.
Isn't this just the best?
The spectacle of it.
Yeah, it has a surreal quality. I haven't missed one yet. He has them every year, you know.
Is that so?
Anyone who's anyone gets an invite.
I didn't.
Me neither.
I spotted the Russians over near the drinks table, pretending to be from somewhere else.
Yeah, we are so glad to be here from either Norway or Sweden.
Yeah. We love America.
I've always wanted to go to Russia.
Oh, we are not knowing anything about the Russia. Why would you want to go there?
Oh, I've seen pictures. I've seen the pictures of the round top castles with the fancy stripes.
Oh, you mean Kremlin? Yes, very beautiful. Very beautiful place. Home of KGB, future home of Trump Tower.
Oh. But we are not knowing anything about Russia, especially Trump Tower.
Well, I would still like to go there. I would.
I thought I'd better check into whatever nutty thing Crazy Mary was saying. I walked over to the drinks table and took a slug out of something out of one of the bottles. Water. Oh, I was hoping for vodka. I nodded to one of the spies, and Mary moved off to the side. Howdy.
Howdy.
Charlie Steen sent me to talk to you.
And what does he want with a nice couple from Scandinavia?
He believes you're the people who contacted him about purchasing some uranium.
Perhaps we should step over here, away from the others.
Follow me. I led them away from the crowd and we stood among the sage and juniper.
Do you have the item in question?
I do. Those barrels over there, full of a yellow cake. Processed at Charlie's plant, part of the very first batch.
But how do we know it is a real thing?
Well, there's a fellow over there with a Geiger counter. Excuse me, sir, can you come over here and bring your Geiger counter?
All right, I'm coming. What is it?
Would you mind pointing your machine at this yellow cake over here?
Sure, I would. Glad
to. You see?
Unless it's trick.
Geiger counters don't lie, right, Bob?
Well, no, but actually...
Nope! Geiger counters don't lie. Science does not lie. It merely seeks to illuminate the facts. Science has no friends or enemies. Only phenomena to study.
Very impressive talk, miss. And the price agreed upon.
$500,000 in U.S. dollars upon delivery. Or rather, simultaneous with delivery. Not a question of trust, merely a precaution Mr. Steen insists upon.
Of course, we understand not the question of trust. Entire KGB is built on not question of trust.
Do you have the money?
Is all the material the agreed upon amount?
Yes, 12 barrels.
Is not trick.
You can check each barrel with a Geiger counter if you want.
I believe I will do that, yes, before we put them on aeroplane.
Bob, can you assist us with your machine again?
Sure, I guess.
I'd like to help.
Sure, you can count the barrels.
Oh, okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 10, 11, 12. Oh.
Okay. I think he's all right.
The money?
I have in briefcase.
Denominations?
$100 bills. 20 stacks of 250 $100 bills.
Let me see. Okay, that looks roughly correct. Let's trade.
Okay, okay.
We will be loading and leaving soon.
Yes, come visit us in Norway or Sweden.
Right.
All right, time to board.
Do svedanya, I mean, hado, that is Swedish.
Hadet, that is, of course, Norwegian.
Yes, well, goodbye.
Bye. Goodbye.
Yellow cake at the top of the barrel, but something else yellow, like chalk, underneath.
Charlie had the first idea.
It was a scandal.
Ed and I refined it.
So why give the Soviets any of the real stuff? They tested a bomb in 1955 that had a yield of 1.6 megatons. So, how about a phony Geiger counter?
And I revised it. That Bob now had Milt's watch, a watch with a radium dial, so Bob's Geiger counter would go off no matter what. Also, I knew the party menu would include cornbread, so I asked Charlie to bring up about a ton of cornmeal from Texas. It's yellow! That's how the swindle went down.
Ooh-wah. Ooh-wah.
Russians weren't as clueless as they seemed.
They got the lowdown.
The Russians were more cagey than they seemed.
Stay on the down low.
This is how they played us. In the end, betrayed us.
We are bringing phony dollars to trade for yellow cake.
Very good counterfeits. Made in USSR, looking like real American dollars. Ha!
And now we are spreading the counterfeits all over America, exploiting the inherent greed of the capitalist system.
That's how this window went down.
Ooh-wah. Ooh-wah, ooh-wah, ooh-wah. Ooh-wah, ooh-wah, ooh-wah.
One thing nobody knew. One thing escaped us all. Crazy Mary stowed away in barrel number 12 and got to see the Kremlin after all.
Just like Disneyland!
Recovering from an overdose of cornmeal, Crazy Mary wandered around the Kremlin asking to see Khrushchev.
He likes Disneyland too!
But that dream never came true. However, she did develop a liking for Schneezhok.
Schneezhok? Goat milk, berries, and syrup. I found me a Russian goat man who taught me how to make it.
Nikita and Anastasia were sent to Siberia and never heard from again.
That doesn't mean we stayed in Siberia, though.
No, we are escaping and fleeing to Sweden.
Actually, Norway, where we are developing a liking for brunost, brown cheese made of goat whey. Delicious.
And Charlie Steen, he sold the Mi Vita and the mill, went through his fortune, made some more, and lost that. Remained devoted to ML and close to his mother.
I always said, Mother and ML believed in me more than I believed in myself.
Maybe it was about the same, Charles.
You always did have a healthy regard for yourself, Charlie dear.
Ed Abbey, well, you've probably heard about him, became famous because of that book he wrote about his 2 years at Arches. Wrote other books that inspired and provoked. Had 5 wives and died too young. They buried him in the desert down in Arizona.
Dirt below, sky above.
The goat man lived on for a few more years, but when he died, they cleaned up his homestead. They destroyed the spot, really. Now it's Lions Park. Can't tell you what happened to the goats and the dogs.
Oh, they died too.
Bob and Ruth never found anything radioactive except for that radium dial on Bob's watch, which he bought from Milt for $10.
Can't help but love this watch. Just checking. Look, Ruth, it's still radioactive.
Will you shut that damn thing off, Bob?
Ernie struck it rich with a moderate vein of uraninite.
Now I eat at Milt's every day.
And yes, Milt and Audrey's cafe is still going. But some other folks run it now. Still the best burger in town.
Sure is nice to have a legacy.
Some folks say Milt's is the last vestige of those uranium days. Well, except for the rocks that are still lying all around town and the millions of tons of uranium tailings by the river.
And me? I stayed on the beat for many years, but the uranium caper was the biggest thing I ever did. I saw then just how clueless humans are. We're clever, but we're not smart. And we just keep making messes that we can't clean up. But hey, without human stupidity, arrogance, and greed, I'd be out of a job. As for uranium itself, it's still a hot commodity. Still being made into weapons that are stockpiled around the planet. The dream of using it for the benefit of humankind has died many times over. What with disasters like Chernobyl and Fukushima. Not to mention the problem of what to do with the waste. Moab's still trying to clean up the radioactive pile left by Charlie's processing plant. U-235 has a half-life of about 4.5 billion years. So in the end, only time will tell.
And that was Act 2 of Uranium the Musical. Act 1 is also posted at kbnf.org. Next up, in honor of Memorial Day, we have a piece called The First Memorial Day from Charles McGuigan.
It's about as American as apple pie, the official kickoff of the long hot summer. As American as a cookout with hot dogs and hamburgers. Almost as American as Independence Day. But where July 4th commemorates our victory over the British, Memorial Day, as it was first observed, remembered the dead of the Civil War. And there were a lot of them to be remembered. Upward of 600,000. Back then it wasn't even called Memorial Day. It was known as Decoration Day, in the North at any rate. It was the idea, so the story goes, of the commander of the Grand Army of the Republic, General John Logan. On May 5th, 1868, Logan, in General Order No. 11, proclaimed May 30th as a National Day of Remembrance. Flowers were placed on the graves of Union and Confederate soldiers interred at Arlington National Cemetery. In fact, the first Memorial Day was observed 127 miles south of Arlington, just below the capital of the former Confederacy, in a country graveyard in a city built along the bluffs and hills overlooking the Appomattox River, a small city called Petersburg. A drenching rain has moved in as I stand in the entrance to the Memorial Chapel at Blandford Church Cemetery, flashes of lightning could easily be mistaken for cannonade still pummeling Petersburg 150 years later, and the thunder, the report of heavy Union artillery.
It was on June the 9th, 1866. Now, I'll back up from that. June the 9th, 1864 was the date of the first attack on the city of Petersburg by the Union forces. They took them 10 months to drive the Union out of here. They finally settled the matter in 1865. Then shortly after that, the Ladies Memorial Association was organized. The reason for organizing it, they wanted to go around over the battlefield areas, the creek banks, the wooded areas, around the many little hospitals they had, collect the remains of those who had fallen and been given hasty burials, and give them a proper burial. Now, that mission took the ladies several years to accomplish. But in the meantime, on June the 9th, 1866, they had a Memorial Day service to commemorate it. And we've had a Memorial Day service every year on June the 9th, every year since then. This coming June the 9th, which is just a couple of weeks from now, there will be standing room only in this building. The people will come here and fill it up, standing room only in this building.
That's Dean Angel, who conducts tours at Blandford Church Cemetery, which is located on Wells Hill, the highest point in Petersburg. Next to Arlington National Cemetery, this is the largest cemetery in the entire state, and it's a sprawling necropolis adjacent to other cities of the dead.
Right across the street from here is People's Cemetery. It started as a slave cemetery in the mid-1850s, in that area, mid-1800s. A slave cemetery. It's a closed cemetery today, but it is. And right adjoining us, down here just the other side of the Catholic and the Jewish cemeteries, Wilkerson Cemetery and another Black Cemetery. They're all right here together.
But Blandford alone has the distinction of being the first cemetery in America to celebrate Memorial Day. Some have suggested that other cemeteries also celebrated Memorial Day back in 1866, some perhaps even earlier than Blandford. But the tradition started at Blandford Cemetery. It was just months after the siege of Petersburg had ended, and the ground must have still been smoldering. One of the founding members of the Ladies Memorial Association ran a school for young women in Petersburg. Her name was Nora Fontaine Mari Davidson, and on June 9th, 1865, she took her charges to Blandford Church Cemetery and had them decorate the graves of both Union and Confederate soldiers with flowers and flags. Those flags, stars and bars and stars and stripes, which flapped over the graves, inspired the creation of our National Memorial Day.
When was our Memorial Day made official?
It was picked up three years later. Mm-hmm. The idea was brought back, attributed to the wife of the then chief military officer in the U.S. Army at that time, General Logan. It was attributed to his wife coming back and seeing the flags put out, and in that case it was Confederate flag, but putting the flags out, and he took it back, and he then made an official edit. And I'm not sure exactly whether it was the next year or the year for it. I'm not sure of that, and I'm not going to try to speculate. It was sometime year later, but it took it from there. And for many, many years, we had the Memorial Day on the 30th of May in this country, until somebody got wise, well, let's just have it on Monday so we can always have a long weekend. 30th of May many times comes on Wednesday or Thursday or Friday, you know, not heavy. And I think if it's going to have it, you have a birthday yourself, don't you? Right. You celebrate it on that day every year. Yes. Why can't you celebrate Memorial Day? We celebrate the 4th of July on the 4th of July.
The memorial chapel we stand in is Episcopal in its darkness, except for the stained glass windows, which even on this rainy, overcast day, glow with an internal, opalescent light.
They went out to the states and asked them for some money to help defray the cost. They told the states, we'll let you put your state seals in the top of the windows. We'll let you put what you want to say in a space that'll be provided at the bottom of the windows. Other than that, they went to Mr. Louis Comfort Tiffany of New York and asked him if he would design and install the windows. They left everything else up to Mr. Tiffany.
As I stand before Dean Angel, He tells me something about each of the 11 stained glass windows in this chapel. His eyes are a piercing blue.
Now look, you and I, and you can look at the windows. There behind me is the Virginia window. It's so St. John. The next one to your left is the Missouri window. It shows St. Peter. The next one is the Mississippi window. It shows St. James. Now, if you were to go down the corner, around the corner, the next one is the Tennessee window. It shows St. Philip. The next one is the Georgia window, and it shows St. Thomas. The next big window is the Florida window, and it shows St. Matthew. The next one is the Texas window, and it shows St. Luke. The next one is the Alabama window, and it shows St. Andrew. Next one is the South Carolina window, and it shows St. Mark.
Dean tells me how many Confederate soldiers, known and unknown, are buried at Blandford. And what is the total number here?
We don't know how many. There's at least 2,000 scattered throughout the cemetery, known graves, at least 2,000 scattered. But there's roughly 30,000 in the unknown graves.
Dean's a japer. He likes to joke a bit, the best kind of tour guide.
Well, I'll tell you how I tell a lot of people that ask right here when I give tours in this area, because you brought the question up. I'll tell you that I'm a Yankee, and then you're going to say where, and I'm going to say I came from North Carolina.
But all the while he's feeding me information about remembrance of those who died in combat, and he knows a thing or two about it. Dean Angel served 22 years in the U.S. Army, before retiring as a lieutenant colonel. He served in Korea and in Vietnam, almost always as a quartermaster.
I was in a quartermaster corps.
You supplied everything.
The first thing you do when you come into service, you want to be fed and clothed and housed. Quartermaster. All the way through your whole life, whether you've been training, whether you've been in war, or what have you, you want to be fed and clothed and housed and supported. The quartermaster. And unfortunately, the last to let you down is the Quartermaster Corps, because they are responsible for grave registration as well.
When he says this, I can't help but think of the gravestones outside, scattered across the rolling hills of Blandford Church Cemetery, as far as the eye can see. And it strikes me as odd that not once during this entire tour has Dean Angel used the word war.
Can't talk about it at all without mentioning that major conflict. And I try to avoid the three-letter word wherever I possibly can. It's a major conflict between the states, and I try to avoid that other three-letter word in talking about it. I don't like to talk about war.
What qualifies as war?
It's a good question. There are 8 books on it. Books say states' rights. Books say states' rights. They say the rights of slavery. They say it's a war of aggression. There are so many things. What qualifies in my mind is that two people couldn't get along, and so they fought it out instead of discussing it out. Boy, it was a war, is no question. I just don't like to use the word war when I talk about it.
How come?
It connotes this bad side of it. We've got over it now. Yes, we're honoring those who paid their life, who gave for what they thought was best for their country, and we've mended it. And I think we've kept it mended. We have some problems, as we well know, and we have those problems. But more and more, we've got to learn to get along with each other. No two human beings in this world all think exactly alike. But we are human beings, and why can't we get along with each other? Why can't we? What's wrong with using the word compromise occasionally?
And then Dean Angel talks about another sort of army, of which he is a member in good standing. He tells me about a war this army declared 25 years ago. In this war, there are no human casualties.
We started in 1985 in Rotary International to eliminate polio around the world. At that point in time, only 4 countries, and I swear, only 15% of the world had been declared health-free by the World Health Organization. The last report for last year, 4 countries had a total of about 360 cases of polio. So that's how close we have done to fighting around the world, gotten together everybody around the world. Those 4 countries, when I name them, you'll understand why it's so tough. Nigeria, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India. Think of it. think about the conflict that you get in those areas, and you'll understand why. The rest of the world is polio-free. If we get those out of the lemon like that, look what Rotary International has done through fellowship and friendship and world health.
As Dean speaks, his eyes become a radiant blue, but they are not like the eyes of Stonewall Jackson, old blue lights. They are not the eyes of a killer angel at Gettysburg. These eyes, which have seen the horrors of war, are generous and compassionate. And what he tells me next cements in my mind for good and all this visit to the home of America's first Memorial Day observance.
I like to tell people, particularly when I tour here on Sunday, I'm touring Blandford Church, be sure and talk about it when you go back home, because you're talking about it, it's our best advertisement. But be sure and tell people that your tour of Blandford Church was given to you by an angel.
Mine eyes have seen the glory of the God of the Lord. He is trampling out the village where the grapes of wrath are stored. He has loosed the faithful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah.
And we'll finish out the Wildcard Hour with another piece for Memorial Day, Airborne Hero, from Kathleen Polanco, about her experiences as a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne Division.
Airborne Hero. Jumping out of airplanes wasn't really my idea of fun. I used to get sick to my stomach at just the thought of a parachute, let alone jumping out of a perfectly good airplane. I was that soldier who only jumped when told to do so. I didn't understand what an honor it was to be a paratrooper. 6 of us from the 82nd Airborne Division were selected to learn more about our unit's history at one of the most historical places in the world, Normandy. I had never felt so excited and embarrassed at the same time, because before June 2015, I had never been to France, nor did I know much about the invasion of Normandy, other than what I had seen on Band of Brothers. I had some expectations of the 10-day trip, but what I experienced was beyond what I had imagined. I knew we were planning to go to the Airborne Museum, the St. Mary Glees Church, and to the Iron Mike Monument, which reminded me of the daunting 5-mile runs to the Iron Mike on Fort Bragg.
Oh, you can break my body down.
Oh, you can break my body down.
Oh, you can break my body down.
But I must admit, I didn't learn as much until I felt the impact that our veterans left on the people in this region. Walking through the town of St. Mary Glees, I saw signs that read, "We will not forget," posted on the windows of several local shops. The cafe baristas welcomed us with open arms, warm smiles, and really strong espresso. French civilians crowded us to take photos with them. We felt like celebrities. They even wore our uniform with our All-American patch and airborne wings. They openly told us their stories and sang our national anthem in French and in English. They were in awe to meet us and eager to welcome us. It was humbling to see and feel so much pride and gratitude for our American veterans. Many things amazed me on this trip, but the one that stood out the most was when I was standing right behind a man wearing a tan jacket that read, "Easy Company." I was standing within finger distance of a hero. I remember nudging the paratrooper next to me and saying, "Look who it is." Now we were both in awe. I didn't know what to do or say. I just knew I wanted to ask him a million questions. But I chose not to trouble the veteran, as he appeared to be struggling to walk down the crowded steps. During one of the days of the trip, all of the junior enlisted soldiers were required to attend formation. As we were marching to an unknown building, I remember thinking that someone had done something stupid and now we were all in trouble. Luckily, that wasn't the case. We knew that senior leaders wanted to talk to us, but we didn't know that those senior leaders were some of the last living World War II veterans. There were six of them that sat on the stage before us. Some sat in wheelchairs and some stood with the help of a cane. One of them was an 88-year-old man named Guy Whitten. He spoke on behalf of his comrades. In a nutshell, he said he was disappointed with this generation of paratroopers because of the lack of pride in what they do and what they represent, and how he wanted us to change. I remember the exact moment of this speech because I felt like he was talking directly to me. After the speech, I had the opportunity to meet Whitten one-on-one. I made sure to spit out all the questions that came to my mind this time. I asked how did it feel to jump into Normandy and what ran through his mind at the time. He said he was scared and nervous and that he didn't think he was going to end up jumping because the weather was poor. His choices were to exit the bird or crash and burn in the aircraft. So, he jumped at 250 feet above ground level with 90 pounds of gear. He had been awake for 24 hours prior to the jump. He said he couldn't wait to land so he could finally get some rest, which is what he got when he hit the unexpected flooded drop zone, unconscious. The next day was the 71st D-Day anniversary. It was the day before our return to the States and the day of our jump onto the same drop zone our veterans landed on. I was nervous because there was a river in the middle of the drop zone and I had never done a water landing before. But for once, I actually wanted to jump. I trusted all the systems that went into play during an airborne operation. I trusted that I was going to be just fine, especially considering I was jumping at 1,200 feet above ground level with no additional gear. And not to mention, I wasn't jumping into a world war. Thoughts of all the veterans who volunteered to jump into combat made me stop feeling scared for myself. Honor kicked in and I felt damn proud to be part of the airborne community. I wasn't jumping for myself anymore. I was jumping for our veterans and for the paratroopers next to me. After my lower body hit the water, causing my torso to slam into the riverbank, a medic sprinted toward me and asked if I was okay. He thought I broke something because I couldn't move my fingers, so he put my hand in a makeshift cast. But little did we know at the time, the river was freezing cold and my hand just needed to warm up. As I was walking off the drop zone, I saw tons of people standing behind white tape. They were cheering us on and had signs decorated in red, white, and blue. They were honoring what we represented, freedom. It was so overwhelming that my eyes started to flood with tears. I lowered my eyes back to the ground to hide the emotions on my face until a man approached me. It was Whitten. He grabbed my casted arm and my shoulder and asked me what had happened. I told him that I hit the riverbank, but that I was okay. I'll never forget his response. He told me that I was a hero and he wanted a picture with me. I was in such disbelief that this World War II veteran, who bravely jumped onto flooded fields with bullets flying at him in all directions along the way to save a generation of tortured people he didn't even know, was calling me a hero. I couldn't help but wonder if he knew how much of a hero he really was, and how much of a difference he made in the world. I gave the paratrooper a hug and told him he was the real hero.
My grandfather and my father told me that men don't cry. So I didn't cry from the time I was a little boy until after the war. So I wondered why I wouldn't cry when I'd see comrades die, but I know I was feeling it inside. And it wasn't until just before my wife died I cried for the first time as an adult. So it kind of hurts inside, you know, because, you know, you care for these guys. We were in the military together for about 3 years at the unit. And you're like brothers, you know. But what's important is the military today. You know, we're just history, that's all we are. But it's you young people that are going to save this world from what it's like right now.
That was the Wildcard Hour on KVNF. Thanks for listening. Up next, we have Cooking with Jazz.